Thank you very much, and thank you for coming. I'll just take a sip of water. And long ago, when I did my first field work for my PhD in the early 1970s, I went up to the far northeast of Finland, where I was doing field work with a particular group of Sami people known as the Skolts. And after a while, I found myself very much absorbed in the business of reindeer herding. It didn't take very long before, like everybody else, I got reindeer on the brain and could talk about nothing else. We found that whenever you spoke to people up there, they'd be talking about the comings and goings of reindeer. And after a while, I was doing the same, so that my field notes are actually full of stuff about reindeer, rather more about reindeer in them than there is about people. And this has been something that has subsequently been a concern. People say to me, "You're supposed to be an anthropologist, aren't you? And they study people. How is it that you go on and on about reindeer?" To which my answer is, "Well, the people I was working with go on and on about reindeer." But it still leaves us as a puzzle whether in anthropology we're supposed to be making studies of people, or whether actually in anthropology we're supposed to be making studies with people about the sorts of things that those people are concerned with, such as other animals. But I also found that the more I was working with reindeer and talking with people who were doing the same, the more I began to think about these reindeer as animals that had quite complicated intentions, memories, who were very aware of the presence of humans and what that meant in terms of their own lives, and which also lived a kind of social life themselves. It was quite evident that they had quite complicated hierarchies, which were based on things like antler size and competition for pastures. So I began to think of these reindeer. I began to talk about these reindeer pretty much as though they were people like us. They were reindeer, and they had their society, and they were people, and they had their society, and maybe there was a sort of society that consisted of both people and reindeer. And so the question that I wanted to start off with now is, can reindeer, you could ask the same question of any other animal, but I just happen to be talking about reindeer, can reindeer have social lives? And when you think about that, you find that biologists, on the one hand, or people who study animal behavior, and social theorists, on the other hand, give rather different answers to this question. They might both agree that, yes, in a sense, reindeer do have social lives, and yet what they mean by that turns out to be something rather different. Biologists would say, yes, reindeer are social animals. They live in herds. They have complicated hierarchies. They compete for females. They do this and that. They communicate with one another. They have memories. So they have social lives, but they only have social lives with one another. So far as biologists are concerned, social means interactions with fellow members of your species. So reindeer social life can only be with other reindeer, perhaps with the exceptional case of reindeer that have been very heavily domesticated and incorporated into human families, but forget that for the moment. Social theorists tend to say, on the other hand, that reindeer fall into a general class of things that they've come to call non-humans. And they say it is as non-humans that reindeer can associate with humans, and that means that they can have a social life. So when social theorists say, oh yes, reindeer can have a social life, it means because they associate in some way with humans in this capacity as non-humans. And this, as I'll show in a moment, carries certain implications. I want to argue that it makes us no more sense to describe the reindeer as a non-human than it makes sense to describe the human as a non-reindeer. My argument is rather that both humans and reindeer are, if you will, particular kinds of goings-on in the world. Those goings-on are things that we denote grammatically by verbs. So I rather think that we should think of to human as a verb. It's something humans do. Humans are humaning, and reindeer are reindeering. So we should introduce a new vocabulary with to human, to reindeer, and so on. And that means, as I shall also show and explain later on, that lives are lived not in interaction, but in correspondence. I shall explain this distinction between interaction and correspondence later on, something I shall come back to at the end. But first of all, let's start with the biological, the rather standard biological animal behavior ecologist view of social relations in non-human animals. It's common for biologists to say that social relations are the set of interactions among individuals of the same species, so that really you have to belong to the same species to have a society. Aggregations of conspecifics. There's a famous definition by E.O. Wilson of society. It goes back to his big book on sociobiology, 1975. Society, a group of individuals belonging to the same species and organized in a cooperative manner. So there it's taken for granted without much discussion. It's more or less as a statement of the obvious, that if you're talking about social relations about animals, the animals have to be of the same species. So you think, why? Why should we make this assumption? It seems on the a priori a very odd assumption to make. Why on earth should we assume that individuals have to be of the same species in order to enjoy a social life? And I started looking into this, and I think the reasons go back, as things so often go back, to a discussion by Karl Marx. And Marx, back in the 19th century, was talking about something that was called species being. And this concept of species being is actually something that he derived from the philosophy of Feuerbach. And Marx was distinguishing between species being and species life. Every animal of any kind has a species life. That's to say, it lives the kind of life it does. A species life for a reindeer is grazing on pastures, moving this way and that way, going on its migrations, doing the sorts of things that reindeer do. That's its species life. But at least according to Marx, following Feuerbach, although he didn't talk about reindeer, if Marx was around, he would say, no, reindeer cannot be a species being. The reindeer cannot be a species being because it has no awareness of its species life. It does its thing, it has its life, and we humans can describe it. But the reindeer itself has no awareness of the kind of life it leads, no awareness that it's living that kind of life rather than any other kind of life because it's a reindeer. Whereas a human, when I say I am a man, I'm also firstly making a statement about my individuality, who I am. But by saying I am a man, I'm setting that individuality against the background of an assumed set of things that all men have in common. I am an instance. I'm one particular representative of this thing, humanity. And I am constructing a sense of my own individuality against the background of this common humanity. And that, for Marx, is what species being is all about. It's about the ability to transcend the natural constraints of life within which all other animals find their existence, to be actually aware of one's own being in the world. And because one is aware of one's own way of being in the world, one can also be aware of the ways of being of other creatures. So one of the things about a species being is that it can model its activities not only in relation to human exemplars, but if you want, you can try and pretend to be any other kind of animal as well. You could pretend to be a reindeer. In fact, humans in some societies do pretend to be a reindeer. If you're a reindeer hunter in Siberia or a caribou hunter in Canada, it's the same animal basically, then one of the most important techniques of hunting is actually to become the animal yourself, in your movements, in your sounds, sometimes in your clothing, and that will attract the animal to you. It's known as mimicry or decoy hunting. And so we can, unlike other creatures, this was Marx's argument, unlike other creatures, humans can be humans. They can also emulate every other kind of creature if they want to. So there's a sort of universality about species being, a sense that you can transcend all those natural differences within which the lives of other animals are constrained. And yet the odd thing about that species being is that while it's about the transcendence of nature, it is also confined to that one particular species that is us. So species being, which is universal and species transcendent, is also species specific. The capacity to be any kind of species is limited to just one species, and that's what species being is for Marx. It's confined to that particular species. Now, this is where the crux of it comes in, because it means that although this notion of human transcendence of nature in the history of Western thought is a well-established and fairly conventional one, it carries this contingent aspect that transcendence is limited to one species. And it opens the door, if we begin to say then that only a species being can enjoy social relations, and that was Marx's argument, then we can say, therefore, social relations are only possible among individuals of the same species, namely the human species. So that a contingent aspect of social relations, that they happen to be among members of the same species, can easily then become its defining feature. And I think it's from there that the argument crept in that, well, if humans can have social relations because relations are among members of the same species, namely the human species, then ants can have social relations if they're with other ants, and baboons can have social relations if they're with other baboons, and reindeer can have social relations if they're with other reindeer. So that this contingent aspect of species being, that it's species specific, became the definitive feature. And it's kind of ironic, this is the irony that I want to draw attention to, that although sociobiologists have gone to great lengths to dismantle the idea of human uniqueness and look for societies and social relations among insects or birds or whatever, their notion that social relations are limited to species actually has its origin in the idea of species specificity, which in turn rests on an idea that humans are quite exceptional in the animal kingdom. In other words, the notion of human exceptionalism, which is deeply embedded in the history of Western thought, is right at the core of the argument that social relations can only be among members of the same species, which sociobiologists have then taken on board in order to show that societies are not unique to humans at all. So there is an irony there, and it shows that this notion of human exceptionalism that underlies the idea of species being is, so to speak, still alive and well. It's still present underneath the sociobiological definitions of society as a group of individuals of the same species interacting in a cooperative manner. Well, then, that's the biology. What does social theory have to say? And on this, I can't talk about all social theorists, and I just want to concentrate on one particular instance. and that is Bruno Latour talking about baboons. The history of this is that in the late 1970s, a primatologist called Shirley Strum organized a baboon conference. It wasn't to be attended by baboons. It was attended by people who studied baboons in order to look at the state of play on studying baboon societies. It was attended by a lot of old men who in the trade are known as silverbacks, who believed that baboon society was based on very rigid relations of dominance and subordination, which were established through male fighting and aggression, the use of the canine teeth competition for females and so on. And Shirley Strum argued that on the basis of her observations, actually baboon society was much more fluid than that, that baboons spend all their time, both males and females, involved in very delicate negotiations about who's on top and who's underneath, who's got what woman at what time. In fact, her conclusions were very close to those that that had been arrived at by another animal psychologist called Nick Humphrey. A couple of years earlier had published an article trying to explain why it was that primates were so intelligent. And his argument was that primates need big brains that are metabolically expensive to maintain, so they've got to have big brains for a reason. They needed big brains not in order to get their food from the environment, because that was really easy, but to do all this complicated negotiation with their fellows. And there's a wonderful bit in this article by Nick Humphrey where he talks about the primate group as a collegiate community. Of course, Nick Humphrey was a Cambridge Don, and so it covers up this the kind of image of complex negotiations for prestige, mates, food, sex, and everything that goes on in a Cambridge college. You find the same in the primate community, and that was the sort of view that Shirley Strum was presenting, that you don't have a rigid hierarchy based on teeth. You have a very flexible, fluid arrangement of individuals that are continually negotiating with one another as to what their position is. And Shirley Strum invited Bruno Latour along to this conference. At that time, Latour was virtually unknown. The Silverbacks almost had Latour thrown out, apparently, but Latour was much taken by Strum's idea of baboon society and went on to collaborate with her in a number of papers, in which Latour and Strum tried to argue that baboon society is indeed something that is continually under construction, continually made in performance, that it's something that the baboons are always working at, that society is the structure is not there to be lived in, the structure has to be made through ongoing performance. And the only instruments, if we can call them that, the only instruments that the baboons can use in this complicated negotiation are their own bodies. So the bodies came to be seen, baboon bodies, as soft tools. That you don't, they don't have hard tools to use, no objects. There are no objects in the baboon world. There are just other baboons who are soft and malleable and easily easily changed, rather mutable. And in this respect, they claimed, baboon society, or any primate society for that matter, differs very fundamentally from a human society. The philosopher Michel Serres, on whom Latour draws quite a lot, had argued that a little earlier, that the thing that makes humans different is the object, the enrollment of objects in social relations. So in relations among baboons, there are no objects as such. They're just subjects. There are no objects, if you like. But human society, human history, according to Serres, begins with the object. At that moment when human beings in prehistory began to enroll objects, things, solid material things like stone tools, into their social life. Now, for various reasons, I think this notion of somehow crossing a barrier in human evolution from there being just soft tools in terms of the bodies of other conspecifics to hard instruments, objects, things, I think the idea of crossing this barrier is something of a myth, and I don't think that it really discriminates in any way between humans and non-human primates. Serres's point was that because human beings have enrolled objects into their social lives, they can stabilize their relationships in a way that other animals cannot, because these objects have a certain immutability and a certain fixity, so that by anchoring a relationship to an object, you can, so to speak, hold it down and inspect it and maybe disaggregate it. You can begin to develop more complicated institutions because you've got something on which to pin down those otherwise ever fluid and fluctuating relationships. That was the argument. But if you actually look at the animal kingdom, you find that, well, for one thing, lots of animals do this too. So if you think about places, for example, many birds return year in, year out to the same places, to the same cliffs, with the same mates to reproduce. Then they go off again, they come back to the same cliffs. And those places actually stabilize the relationship between of the mating couple relationship of those birds over many, many years. In the case of reindeer again, reindeer have very good memories for places. Female reindeer always go back to the same place year in, year out to have their calves. The calf then gets to know the place, and that then is carried on through generations. So both in the case of seabirds and in the case of reindeer, fixed places serve to stabilize relationships between mating couples in the case of birds and between mothers and offspring in the case of reindeer. So I don't think there's anything particularly human about anchoring social relationships to particular places. We know humans do that, but there's nothing. I don't think there's anything peculiarly human about it. And the other side of the argument might be that, well, we all know that although other animals use all sorts of objects, and some of these objects they've made themselves, still, compared with any other animal you can think of, the extent to which humans use tools and equipment of one sort and another is just massive and goes on right through life. There's a wonderful book by the archaeologist Michael Schiffer on human material culture, in which he starts in the first chapter with an imaginary scenario that a research team of chimpanzees has come to do a sociological study of a human group. And the first thing that these chimpanzees notice, to their astonishment, is that all kinds of things that they are quite used to, all kinds of activities that they're quite used to doing directly on one another, like grooming or getting rid of insects from hair and so on, are done by these humans using curious bits of equipment like hairbrushes and combs and so on, right from the beginning to the end. So that would be the immediate thing that would strike our chimpanzee researchers, that these humans, I mean, the chimpanzees maybe use a few tools, but these humans, they're using tools all the time. That's a really striking thing. But we also know from anthropological studies of hunters and hunting and gathering people that for the most part, particularly among mobile populations who don't want to be tied down by masses of goods, for the most part, people improvise the bits of equipment they need on the spot from locally occurring raw materials and then chuck them away again when they're finished. And that a lot of these tools, objects of use, of everyday use, carry no social weight, no social significance whatever. Indeed, the hunters and gatherers seem in some ways rather like affluent people of the modern Western world who are so surrounded by commodities that they really end up being more than accidentally similar to baboons, as described by Latour. And so they're continually having to negotiate their relationships with others and their prestige and their position in society through the use of so many different objects that no single object is able to stabilize relationships at all. So I'm not sure, really, that there's such a clear difference between non-humans and humans in terms of the way in which objects stabilize human relationships. But it's really interesting to see how Bruno Latour tackles this problem in one of the essays in the collection called Pandora's Box. He imagines the point at which humans first began to enroll what he's calling non-humans, objects, into the sphere of their social relationships. He imagines that first hunter making the first stone tool in order to bring down an animal. And he says that's the moment when humans begin to enroll non-humans into the field of their social relationships. But who or what is being enrolled? Not the animal that's being hunted, but the stone tool. And that's really remarkable. And it's showing that actually he's thinking of non-humans in terms of objects that can be enrolled into human society in an instrumental capacity, not in terms of forming relationships with other living beings, such as the animals that are being hunted. So when Latour and other social theorists following him talk, as they do, about convocations of humans and non-humans, on the one hand, there are the humans who are restless, mutable, animate beings. But on the other side, the non-humans all seem to be emplaced, fixed, and durable entities that have been enrolled in order to help provide that stabilizing function for social relationships. Now, that kind of convocation, restless, mobile human beings, fixed, durable object, is very odd because something very important is left out. And what is left out are all those restless, mutable, animate beings that don't happen to be human. They have all somehow got lost. We only have, on the one hand, humans, and the other hand, non-humans that all seem to have become objects. Although they might be animate, somehow the inanimate object has become the paradigm case of the non-human. So if you go back to the reindeer, there are two ways in which we might think of the reindeer as a non-human. We might say that the reindeer is a sort of an object of material culture, a material object that has semiotic significance that can be used by humans to stabilize their relationships. And indeed, reindeer are used in that capacity. Every reindeer carries on its ears a mark, and which is cut, and the mark is an index of who owns it. And more than that, because marks, the particular combination of marks actually tells a story about a person's genealogical relationships. They marks pass down family lines, and so you know, if you go from father to son, the father's mark might just have one notch, and the son's mark has an extra notch added, so that you can, if you really know about these things, you can read off from the earmark pattern on a reindeer not only who owns this animal, but something about that owner's genealogical position in the society as a whole. Reindeer, of course, apart from the rather mildly painful business of having the mark cut in your ear, reindeer can't see the mark at all and know absolutely nothing about it. It's of no significance for them because they can't even see it. I have the same problem with their ears that I'm having with this equipment here. I can't actually see it because it's too close, and I can't see my ears. And reindeer don't go around a place looking at mirrors and admiring themselves in mirrors. So the earmark is of no significance to the reindeer, but it's of great significance for the people. So that as a marked object, as a piece of property, the reindeer can indeed be treated as a material semiotic resource within the network of human relationships. It can be enrolled in that capacity. But another way of thinking of the reindeer would be to say, well, it's rather like a baboon. Actually, and although reindeer and baboons live in completely different parts of the world in completely different ecological situations, they do have some things in common, that just as baboon society is very fluid and there's lots of complicated negotiations going on about access to food and women and so on, it's just the same with reindeer as well. Very complicated negotiations, very fluid kind of social life. So it's the same sort of thing. But then you could regard the reindeer not as an object that is being enrolled in human society, but as a being in its own right that's living its social life with other reindeer. But in that capacity, according to this theory, the reindeer is only allowed to have social relations with other reindeer. It's not allowed to have relationships with humans, for example, as a negotiating, living, animate, mobile being. It can only relate to humans as a bearer of an earmark. So we have this curious situation in which you take a non-human animal, and in terms of social theory, it can be understood in either one or the other of two ways. It can be understood as an object that can be enrolled within the sphere of human relations in order to stabilize them, or it can be viewed as a strategic, animate, mobile being, but it can only relate to others of its kind. Because these social theorists are quite happy to take on board the biologist's notion of a society so long as they're dealing with non-humans. So long as you're talking about baboons, or so long as you're talking about reindeer, they're quite happy with the idea that, of course, social relations are only with conspecifics. It's only when you move to humans that they say, no, now we have to expand the scope of social relations to include all these other non-humans as well. And that's why I find this whole position so paradoxical or even hypocritical in a way, because Latour and others claim to be fighting the founding myths of modernism. And yet this whole construction, and to establish a symmetrical point of view in which we treat humans and non-humans equally, and yet this whole construction is based on the founding myth of human exceptionalism, namely that humans differentiated themselves from all other animals at the point, at that founding moment, at which they began to co-opt objects as instruments, as having a mediating role in the management of social relations. So there are two ways in which one could think of a non-human. One could think of it as an object of what theorists sometimes call material culture, meaning things that can be co-opted as extra-somatic mediators for human endeavors. Or one could think of the non-human as a form of animate life, as a being that follows its own calling while responding to the lives and calls of humans. And then perhaps we could argue that the essence of sociality actually lies in the way in which these different human and animal lives are carrying on and responding to one another. And I'll come back to that in a moment. The problem, it seems to me, is that for theorists of material culture, those sorts of theories have been very dominant in this field. For theorists of material culture, forms of animate life are, in a sense, the wrong kinds of non-humans. We're being told that in the course of social evolution, human beings enrolled all these non-humans in their social lives. More and more and more and more. Sometimes this idea is presented almost in an evolutionary fashion, as though at the beginning of human evolution, there weren't many non-humans about. But as humans evolved from hunting and gathering to agriculture to industry, the scope and diversity and sheer quantity of these non-humans increased and increased and increased. And this is what enabled human society to evolve from a primitive hunter-gatherer band to the modern industrial state. You find these kinds of evolutionary scenarios, very 19th century scenarios in their way, reproduced in a lot of contemporary social theory. As if you went back to a little group of hunter-gatherers somewhere, you wouldn't find many non-humans about. But if you go to a society like ours, why, there are non-humans everywhere. This is very odd. If you go back to a hunter-gatherer society, there are lots of non-humans about, all over the place, that you're completely surrounded by creatures of all sorts. And if you're a hunter-gatherer, you're probably negotiating with these creatures and communicating with them and maybe hunting them, which is a social relationship of a kind anyway. You're engaged in all kinds of intercourse and engagements with these non-human beings. But for material culture theorists, those are the wrong kinds of non-humans. And they're the wrong kinds of non-humans because they are animate living beings in their own right, rather than things that signify, that can carry out the weight of ideas or action within human society. And that's why I think you so often find in the writings of many such theorists statements to the effect that for much of the history of social science, there's been a shameful neglect of non-humans in the literature. They keep writing to saying that in social science, we have proceeded as though the non-human world didn't exist, as though the only world there is a human world. This is wrong, they say, and we must put it right. We've got to bring all these non-humans in. For me, with a background that coming from my own background in ecological anthropology and having had to read all the monographs of anthropologists written over the last 50 to 100 years on farming societies, on pastoral societies, on hunter-gatherer societies, this notion that non-humans are missing from the literature is completely preposterous. They have been there all along, and the literature is completely stuffed with them. But it's not the literature of material culture studies. It's actually a literature of ecological anthropology. And one of the odd things that has happened in recent years is that ecological anthropology and material culture studies have really got very dissociated from one another. They're speaking different languages. One is talking about the enrolment of objects, the other is talking about relations between humans and their non-human environments. And I think this is one of the reasons for this particular kind of split, that in terms of material culture studies, the non-human is characteristically an inanimate object, and this notion can then be extended to animate beings, but only by treating them as if they were inanimate, as if they were mere bearers of earmarks and symbolic resources, not as living beings in their own right. So we need, I think, to get back to a different vision of social life, in which life and indeed history is continually made through the carrying on, the ongoing lives of creatures of all sorts, not just humans, so that we can think of society and history not simply as human achievements brought about through the enrolling of all these non-humans, but to think of them as histories of humans and animals of different sorts going along together, which means, of course, that we can no longer think of history simply as a human achievement. It's an achievement of all these things going along side by side. And this particular view, I think, has been articulated very beautifully in a series of papers by French philosopher Dominique Lestel and his collaborators in the wonderfully named Laboratory of Eco-Anthropology and Ethnobiology in Paris. And the fundamental point that Lestel makes, and this is really of critical importance, I think, is that all societies are hybrid in their species composition. So his basic idea is that any community we might look at is a hybrid community. There can be no possibility of a society that consists only of members of one species, because whatever kind of creature you are, you're having to deal with animals of other kinds. You have to eat, you have to negotiate, you have to find your way around, you have to defend yourself, you have to communicate, you have to say what your position is in relationship to all the other beings that you encounter in the environment that you're in, whether you're a human being or a reindeer or a baboon or whatever. Therefore, all societies are hybrid, and therefore it makes no sense to put the name of a creature in front of the word society. It makes no sense to talk about baboon society, or reindeer society, or human society, or chimpanzee society, that a society is always going to be made up of reindeer, baboons, chimpanzees. Whoever happens to be around in the environment is going to be part of that society, if we think of society as ongoing lives. And one of the nicest images comes from the geographer Doreen Massey. She's actually talking about the meaning of space and arguing that we shouldn't think of space simply as a plane, a continuum on which lives are led, but rather for her, space is what she calls the simultaneity of stories so far. So we imagine that every animal, every being, is its own story. And those stories are going along together, carrying on, responding to one another, rather like lines of musical counterpoint in music or polyphony. The lines are running along together. And at a particular moment, we might say, okay, at this moment, all these stories are at this particular point. And we call that, that's what Massey calls space, the simultaneity of stories so far. So society, social life, is something that's carrying on along all these lines at once, the lines responding to one another, becoming each creature becoming what it is in a continual ongoing relation to all the others. But that makes the Lestellian hybrid community a quite different kind of thing from the collective or convocation of Latour. Latour's collectives includes people and then all the objects that are enrolled by those people in their human life. But the Lestellian hybrid community includes all those restless, mutable, roving, mobile beings with whose lives our own lives are necessarily entangled. It includes all those wrong kinds of non-humans, those non-humans who aren't just objects, but are living, ongoing, living creatures. And this is to allow the animals back in to our understanding of social life. It is to allow the animals back in as beings in their own right, with biographies and political lives of their own, and not just as material semiotic resources for human projects. So what I've shown so far is that I think a certain view of human exceptionalism underpins both the biological and the social theoretical account of what social life is and what kind of social lives are possible. And that we need to get rid of that notion that somehow humans are completely different from any other kind of being in the world, in order to arrive at a concept of social life where we allow all these different creatures to be themselves, so that a reindeer is a reindeer and not a non-human, and a human is a human, not a non-reindeer, where each being is what it is and does what it does, but doing what you do is something that carries on in time. And that means thinking of creatures not as objects. And this is where I want to get back to the distinction I introduced right at the beginning between interaction and correspondence. Mostly, when we talk about relations between humans and non-humans, when we talk about actor networks and networks of relationships, we envisage something like this. We envisage each participant as a sort of little circle or a dot, and then we join them up and say, here's a network. And we might put some arrows on here and there, like this. They're always pointing both directions to show that everything in the network is both acting on everything else, and everything else is acting on everything back to this way, that way. So each of these things, each of these double-headed arrows, is an interaction. But that's to treat these participants as things that are wrapped up in themselves. But living beings are not wrapped up in themselves. They're continually becoming. They're continually undergoing a process of life in which they are, so to speak, making themselves in the world through the engagements they have with other creatures. So what I want to do is to take each of these and turn them from being wrapped up in itself into a line. So there's one of them. Let's say that's A. Now here's another one. Let's say that's B. And so on. We can have all the others. And so on. All of them are going on. In this case, the arrow is just going in one direction. It's not a back and forth. So interaction is a back and forth between points. This is what I'm calling correspondence. And I want to argue that it's in the correspondence of ongoing lives that we find the essence of the social. And the image I have in mind here is of musical polyphony. So it's very popular these days to talk about parts and wholes and talk about this kind of arrangement as an assemblage, putting a number of parts together into a whole. It is not necessarily complete. One can always add further bits, but it's like you're sort of sticking things together to form a sort of conglomerate, and the part is like one bit of that conglomerate. But in music, the part is a line. It's a particular, if it's choral music, it's the line that the tenor or the alto or the soprano is singing, and as it is singing, it's continually responding in counterpoint to the other lines. So that as every animal life is carrying on, it's also responding all the time to the lives that are carrying on with it. So that we can begin to think of parts more like lines of musical polyphony than as objects of an assemblage. It's like taking an interaction, this thing. It's like taking that interaction and putting it in movement, putting it in a dimension, basically, of time, so that we begin to see it as carrying on. And it's by turning these from objects into carryings on that we turn the object into a verb. So now we have not human beings, but human becomings, who are, what they do is what they are. They are humaning. We have reindeer who are reindeering, baboons who are babooning. And as they carry on, so lives become entangled and intertwined. So it's not unreasonable for a Sami person to say, I've got reindeer on the brain. Literally, they have. It's not unreasonable for a baboon researcher like Strum to say that somehow she feels only herself when she's with her baboons, that outside the company of the baboons, she's somehow left feeling lost and inadequate, that her life has become so bound up, as we say, with the lives of her research subjects, the animals, that she feels incomplete without them. It's quite reasonable to argue that a reindeer that has become accustomed to the camps, the sounds and the smells of human camps, has become, in some sense, the reindeer it is because of the way it's lived in proximity to humans. So that every animal is becoming the particular animal it is through the history of its relationships with others. Of course, that does have enormous consequences if we start thinking about animals in that kind of way, because it makes the whole concept of species a very difficult one to sustain. Because it's to say that, for example, a baboon that has been brought up in the company of human researchers is not actually the same kind of animal as a baboon that's been brought up mainly in the company of other baboons. But it also means we can no longer be content with the idea, as Latour puts it somewhere, that a sociology of the standard kind, a sociology of the social, is fine for baboons, he says. It just doesn't work for humans. Meaning that it's okay, we can use standard sociology as long as we're talking about non-human animals that are not bothering with anything outside its own conspecific ambit, but with humans that doesn't work. But this is nonsense, because even if you're a baboon, you have to deal with a lot more than other baboons. You have to eat. You have to pay attention to dangerous predators in your environment. You have to relate to the world around you, which includes all kinds of other beings. So that even for the baboon, the community is a hybrid community of creatures of different sorts. And every creature is becoming the creature it is in and through that history of ongoing correspondences with other lives. I just wanted to end with one final thought. I don't know whether any of you have come across the latest fashion. The philosophical fashions come and go, but one of the latest fashions is a thing called object-oriented ontology, known for short as OOO. Looks like that. And the object-oriented ontologists are on the face of it saying something rather similar to what I'm saying, which is that we should let everything in the world be itself in its own right. And I'm saying that. Let reindeer be reindeer. Let baboons be baboons. Let humans be humans. Let them do their thing in their animate, mutable, engaged way. Don't just treat them as signs or objects for recruitment into human society. So maybe, but what the object-oriented ontologists are saying is that every object, at the end of the day, retreats into itself. It is fundamentally and ultimately its own thing. I could engage with this glass, I could pick it up, I can drink from it, but somewhere inside, the glass is a glass is a glass. There's a fundamental objectness to it which resists any attempt of me to try and turn it into something of my own. But there is a big difference between what I'm proposing here and what the object-oriented ontologists are proposing. What we have in common is both are saying that you don't necessarily have to have humans around to have relationships of any kind. So that, and they presented us a big discovery. Wow, things, rocks and plants and animals can relate to one another without there being any humans there. So this is a great philosophical discovery. Although, of course, ecologists have been studying these things for decades. But I agree, too. Of course, you can have correspondences going on. No one of these lines needs to be a human line. You don't have to have humans there at all. That we have in common. But the difference is that these lines are alive. They're moving. They're growing. The object-oriented ontologists are everything is inside itself. So the kind of world that the object people want, the world of objects, is one in which everything is fossilized. Everything is, in the end, contracted into itself. So it's a world in which fundamentally nothing moves, in which there is no time. And mine is a world, I think, in which everything moves. So as against the objects of object-oriented ontology, I've got what I want to call a WWO, a world without objects. In a world of lines, there are no objects at all. Everything is moving, flowing, responding to one another. And that's because we have to think of things in the first place not as blobs, like this, but as lines. There I'll stop. Thank you.